This is a Veterans Day special from Iowa Public Radio. In Uniform celebrates Iowans who served in the armed forces. I'm Rick Fredrickson, and in the next hour, we showcase rare recordings and the voices of men and women in uniform. We'll start the show with the poignant story of an anti-war student who wore a POW bracelet 40 years ago and finally tracked down the former prisoner just last month in Iowa. We've interviewed both men and will remember the joyful POW homecoming gala at the White House. We'll go back to the Civil War and remember America's longest conflict, the Cold War, with classic sound clips from our collection of historic audio, like Jack Shelley's dramatic countdown of an atomic bomb test. Lots of surprises along the way, including a ride on a B-17 bomber. Our Veterans Day salute begins after the news. This is a special production from Iowa Public Radio News. In Uniform is a tribute to military veterans who served in war and in peace, and in all branches of the service. Also their family members who have shared the burden. I'm Rick Fredrickson, and in the coming hour, we'll tell some of their stories with rare audio from our Iowa Archive Sound Project. Some of the show is brand new, other portions are historical and worth listening to again. In Uniform remembers Iowa veterans who are gone and thanks those who are still with us. We start with a remarkable email that came to Iowa Public Radio this past Labor Day weekend, from a man who was home visiting his mother.
Mom was pulled out one of her keepsake boxes, because she always does that whenever I go home. And she pulled out the little silver bracelet, which was the POW MIA bracelet I had worn, you know, as a freshman, sophomore in high school, which I had completely forgotten about.
This is Bernie Contreras, who works for IBM in Jacksonville, Florida.
I had my computer in front of me, and I said, well, geez, I need to Google and find out what happened to this guy. And it said the name on the bracelet was Lieutenant Larry H. Spencer. The good part was that he returned home in February 1973 with the first wave of POWs were returned. So I was very, very, you know, happy and quite emotional, and tears started welling up in my eyes. And so I want to know more about this guy. And then I found a link to your Iowa Public Radio piece that you did in February earlier this year, and got the ball rolling.
We'll continue the POW bracelet story after the background on Larry Spencer, the former POW from Iowa. On the 40th anniversary of his release, IPR News went back to that defining moment of the Vietnam War. Here's the story we broadcast last February. In May of 1973, President Nixon invited all the returning POWs to a star-studded White House celebration. Iowan John Wayne was there to welcome them.
You men, I want to say thanks for showing the whole world the kind of men a free country can put up when the going gets rough. You're the best we have. And I'll ride off into the sunset with you anytime.
One of those men was Navy Commander Larry Spencer. Tomorrow marks the 40th anniversary of Spencer's release from North Vietnam.
You can get beat up with black and blue spots and scrapes from being drug across the floor and everything, and in a couple of weeks, you're as good as new.
Spencer is one of about a dozen men with Iowa connections who lived the POW nightmare.
It's not like Hogan's Heroes on TV, trust me.
Spencer was a radar intercept officer. He was only 25 years old when his Phantom jet was shot down by a surface-to-air missile. For the next 7 years, he was subjected to brutal conditions in North Vietnamese prisons, including the Hanoi Hilton.
The Vietnamese were small of stature, but large numbers of people can force you to do anything. It's an illusion if anyone thinks that they cannot be forced to do something they don't want to do.
Interrogators and guards used harsh methods to enforce behavior, extract confessions, and make the POWs go beyond name, rank, and serial number. The prisoners were beaten and put in solitary confinement. They were tied up and left dangling from the ceiling, or medical treatment was withheld. Like other prisoners, Spencer still suffers the consequences of this abuse even today.
The nerves in our hands and feet have been damaged because of malnutrition.
The POWs are also prone to arthritis at an earlier age. For Spencer, balance is a chronic issue.
Good morning, everyone. Let's take a big deep breath.
He says going to this local fitness class at the Waukee YMCA helps.
Every Tuesday and Thursday morning, he's always in the front row ready to go.
Becky Holmes leads the fitness class.
He hides it very well. He's adapted very, very well.
Spencer was one of many returning POWs who had to adapt. 591 of them flew from Hanoi to Clark Air Base in the Philippines over a period of 2 months. Iowa reporter Harry Reisner was one of the national broadcasters who covered Operation Homecoming.
The first group of American prisoners released under the Vietnam Peace Agreement have now had a day to enjoy the emotions of freedom.
The returning POWs included Senator John McCain, former vice presidential candidate James Stockdale, and Pete Peterson. Peterson grew up in Iowa and would become America's first post-war ambassador to Vietnam. Senator Jeremiah Denton Jr. was also one of the returning prisoners. Denton is remembered as the POW who blinked his eyes in Morse code to spell out the word torture during an interview for a propaganda film produced by his Vietnamese captors. Ottumwa native Harold Johnson remembers those propaganda movies well. He was in them as a baritone in one of the POW choirs. Johnson says these films, recorded in a prison that used to be a French movie studio, were then distributed by the news media.
And they'd set it up, and we performed Christmas carols, and they'd bring in a few prisoners and watch us very carefully so we didn't get any communications. And that's where I was when my wife happened to see me on TV release some of those films that they'd taken.
Johnson is a highly decorated Air Force officer who was captured after his F-105 was shot down. He spent 2,135 days as a POW and was at the Hanoi Hilton when the peace agreement was announced.
Oh God, to thee we raise the prayer and sing.
Soon after, Johnson sang in the prison chorus again, but this time it was at the White House party celebrating the POW's return. At the event, President Nixon talked about the controversial choice he made to launch a punishing bombing campaign over North Vietnam.
I think that all of us would like to join in a round of applause for the brave men that took those B-52s in and did the job.
The job was designed to coax Hanoi back to the peace talks. Within a month, the communists returned to the bargaining table and a peace settlement was signed. But the bombing campaign was costly. More than 24 aircraft were shot down, including 15 B-52s. In this cockpit recording from the actual mission, the air crew watches as a surface-to-air missile takes out another B-52.
Got the other airplane, Bob.
I got it. Two visual sound, 6 o'clock. I got that airplane. Holy crap, visual sound!
During the 12-day campaign, close to 100 airmen were taken prisoner or killed, including an Iowan. Spencer and Johnson are both in their 70s now. Johnson winters in Florida. Spencer lives in West Des Moines and gives motivational speeches on how to cope with hardship.
We had 2 meals a day, and it was soup and bread or soup and rice.
He tries to use his experience to inform others.
The lessons you learn are about dealing with adversity, what works to help you get through that. You tend to think mostly about the positive things that came out of it rather than the negative. Sometimes you have to look pretty hard to find something to be positive about.
Ann Spencer accompanies her husband on his appearances and joins the fitness classes.
He gets up in the morning and I think he thinks back, not consciously, but subconsciously somewhere. He says, you know, I can get up and do what I want today. And he's always saying options. If you have options, you have everything.
Around 500 Vietnam POWs were still alive this year. And in May, many of them attended the 40th anniversary commemoration of that White House party at the Nixon Presidential Library in California. Prior to Operation Homecoming, Americans in the States were wearing metal bracelets engraved with the names of the prisoners, as well as those missing in action. Starting in the late 60s, the National League of POW/MIA Families sold them to raise awareness on the issue, hoping to pressure the North Vietnamese to improve their living conditions. In Florida, Bernie Contreras wore the bracelet emblazoned with the name Larry Spencer.
I mean, I was a kid. I was, 14, 15 years old, freshman and sophomore in high school at that time. I was anti-war.
Bernie recently found the bracelet tucked away at his mother's home and wanted to give the keepsake back to Larry.
Long story short, Larry Spencer called me last week. He thanked me for wearing, the bracelet back 40 years ago, but he graciously declined my offer to return the bracelet to him because he said it was more important for me to keep it in my keepsake box, for example, so that someday some other family member will find it, ask me about it, and I'll tell them the story about Larry Spencer and the Vietnam War and the POWs and MIAs.
Right after his release, Spencer says he received about 1,000 of the wristbands, and four decades later, still gets about 5 or 6 calls a year from people who are finding them even today.
I love the opportunity to tell people that this is an example of something that really did make a difference. For example, if your towel is the size of a washcloth, and the next time they issue towels, it's the size of a hand towel, that's noticeable in your little world, which was so basic and which had so many things that were the same day after day after day. When the cigarette ration went to 6 a day, that's a 100% increase in your standard of living if you measure it in terms of cigarettes. So we knew that something had happened.
There's one more coincidence in this lost and found connection between the POW and Bernie Contreras, who adorned his wrist with Spencer's name.
When I graduated from college, I joined the Navy and, became part of the military itself. I've never been anti-military. I was just anti that war. So I ended up being a Navy officer just like Larry Spencer was.
For now, Bernie keeps the bracelet on his bedside nightstand and will try to arrange a face-to-face welcome home next year. In the meantime, the bracelets are still available. There are more than 1,600 Americans still missing in the Vietnam War. 25 are from Iowa. It was a very good year, any year that veterans come home. This rendition of the classic song was performed at the Valair Ballroom in 1967 by the Iowa National Guard's 34th Army Band. After this break, In Uniform continues. Still to come, stories from the Civil War, World War I, World War II, Korea, the Cold War, and Afghanistan. You're listening to In Uniform, a special program from Iowa Public Radio News, a salute to Iowa veterans. When the Iowa Veterans Cemetery opened near Van Meter in 2008, then-director Patrick Palmersheim never dreamed it would be a resting place for any World War I veterans. But in 2010, a soldier who died 36 years earlier in Cedar Falls was laid to rest there. The cremains of Captain James Perrine were left forgotten in a funeral home. The ceremony was one of the last funerals in the country for a World War I vet. Captain Perrine was in uniform when Germany surrendered in 1918. He was remembered by Brigadier General Janet Phipps.
He wrote the Slide Rule Handbook in 1963. During World War II, he advised the U.S. Navy on submarine detection. So it's with these words we pay our respects and commit Captain James Perrine to his final rest. Thank you.
Camp Dodge, Iowa's largest military training facility, has been around for every war since World War I, commemorating its centennial in 2009. Our historic sound project discovered a treasure trove of old recordings at the Gold Star Museum, including the voices of the people who lived and worked there.
I had account for the horses we'd received and lost.
World War I veteran Wilbur Boyne from Des Moines was a charter member of the American Legion. He was interviewed at the age of 103.
According to my record, we lost more horses than we received. And the captain says, well, that's good. He says, if it had been the other way around, we'd have been in trouble. So.
Early automobiles also traveled the camp's dusty roads. Dorothy Ponell used one to cover Camp Dodge as a newspaper reporter for the Des Moines Capital.
We had a Model T Ford we called Lizzie. I never had such a good time in my life.
She sat for this interview in Iowa City in 1977 and remembered the thousands of young Iowans who were drafted in World War I and trained at Camp Dodge.
They were delighted that they had been chosen.
There wasn't really the bitterness about being taken from your job or your home.
Oh, no, no. They all seemed to enter into it with so much enthusiasm.
Dorothy was at Camp Dodge during the deadly flu pandemic and covered the VIP visits of Teddy Roosevelt, Eddie Rickenbacker, and General Leonard Wood. Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri was named in honor of the general. This undated recording has the sounds of boot camp there, where many Iowa soldiers have trained. Another soldier named Wood was also destined for fame, but future artist Grant Wood was just another face when he was at Camp Dodge in 1918. That's when Art Rasmussen from Weston arrived. He was joined by recruits from southern Iowa and Missouri.
They were mostly farmers, and I know some of them weren't able to read or write. I remember writing to one fellow's wife for him and reading her letters to him.
The World War I veterans are all gone now, but not forgotten. And soldiers from an even earlier war are remembered always by the Des Moines Civil War Roundtable. 2012 was the 150th anniversary of Americans fighting Americans. There were no major Civil War battles in Iowa, but reenactments like this one in Keokuk illustrate the savagery of frontier fighting. More than 13,000 Iowans died during the conflict, more even than World War II.
We're not celebrating the war. We're celebrating what happened.
Ron Nurmi is adjutant of the Des Moines Civil War Roundtable, a group of enthusiasts who meet in honor of the 4 years that changed America forever. More than 70,000 Iowans, half the state's eligible young men, signed up for the Union Army in proportionately larger numbers than almost any other state. Roundtable member John Liapa teaches a Civil War course at the Des Moines Area Community College.
It was just loyalty to the country, a sense of patriotism, but I think there's something else too, and as you read the diaries of a lot of these Iowa soldiers, it comes through, is a sense of adventure. Iowa was still very rural, it was a frontier state and so on, and a lot of these kids had never been further than a few miles from their home.
These Iowans had become scholars on the flashpoints of the 1860s, the slavery issue, presidential powers, military strategy. Some, like Glenn Kappelman of Ames, have direct links to the Civil War.
Two of my great-grandfather's uncles were killed. I think if you know that your ancestors were involved in this, it makes your history then, it's the history of the people.
Iowa's wartime history includes heroes and sacrifices from all wars as recent as this decade. This is a send-off ceremony for Iowa National Guard members bound for Afghanistan. The deployment was massive, 2,800 men and women, the largest call-up since 1941. In the crowd at Camp Dodge, Daylene Chickering from Omaha worried about her departing husband. And Daryl McGill from Maxwell kissed his wife goodbye.
You know, proud of him, but at the same time scared.
It's a little heart-wrenching. You know, you think you're ready for it. I think we're going to go kick some ass.
When the mission was finished and the troops came home the following year, there was an emptiness. There were casualties, and 4 soldiers were killed. Our longest war was the Cold War, which started in the post-atomic bomb era.
That signal means to stop whatever you are doing and get to the nearest safe place fast.
Spanning decades, Americans built bomb shelters and kids were taught what to do in case of a nuclear attack.
What are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Duck and
America was on edge and concerned about the devastation of the atomic arsenal.
Long distance.
Long distance. We'd like to place a call to New York City, Meredith Wilson.
The year is 1953, and above-ground nuclear testing was still being conducted. Everybody was talking about it. In a phone call to Mason City's famous composer Meredith Wilson, KGLO Radio's Doug Sherwin asked Wilson about the weather in New York. It had been raining every day, and Wilson made nuclear testing sound like today's global warming controversy.
Some kind of rain almost every day. And this isn't so bad, excepting one gets very bored with the same comment that you get from everybody. Every taxi driver in town, you know, says, you know, I believe that this rain is caused by the atom bomb experiments. And you get that from everybody, every place you go. So you begin to believe it after a while.
Pioneer reporter Jack Shelley even covered one of the test explosions in Nevada. This classic sound clip is from 1953.
The men stand silently in the trenches. The loudspeaker is giving us instruction. There goes the siren. To the right and the left of me, the troops are kneeling. Their heads are bent. I'm going to put my hand over this microphone when the moment comes of the blast. 3, 2, 1. There's the bright light with my eyes shut. I can see that tremendous light. The earth is shaking underneath me. Not too bad. There's the sound. There is the tremendous sound. This trench is being filled with dust. But I can see dimly the men to the right and the left from me. I can see them. Nobody seems to be in the least degree hurt.
Nuclear test detonations were later moved underground, but the fallout didn't seem to harm Jack Shelley, who lived to the age of 98.
It can smash in buildings and knock signboards over and break windows all over town.
The A-bomb, Khrushchev, Cuba, Gary Powers, the Berlin Wall. There were flashpoints everywhere. Colonel Les Van Heeswijk, originally from Afton, had a tense job during the Cold War. He flew U-2 spy planes near sensitive hotspots, peering down from an altitude of 60,000 feet, so high he had to wear a spacesuit.
Prior to each flight, you went in a couple hours before your takeoff time, and they put you in the suit on, and then put your helmet on, and hooked you up to 100% oxygen, and you pre-breathe for an hour prior to takeoff to get the nitrogen out of your blood. People understand a scuba diver, when they go down in depths and then come back up, they worry about the bends.
World War II veterans have been coined the greatest generation, and we'll include Iowa reporters who covered their harrowing stories and left behind some remarkable audio recordings, including Herb Plambeck.
Hello, NBC. I thought we were going to start a minute from the time I said. Maybe you didn't understand the signal.
The year is 1945, and the nation's first farm broadcaster is covering the war for WHO Radio.
This is Herb Plambeck again.
Davenport native Herb Plambeck would file his censored reports by shortwave, transmitting from a military facility to London and then across the Atlantic. He was with the 7th Army soon after American tanks pulled up to Stalag 13D, where the Germans held 14,000 POWs.
My first impressions, as our jeep wheeled up to the enclosure, were the high, ugly barbed wire fences, ominous lookout posts, dismal barracks, drab gray tents, lack of sanitary facilities, the hated swastika, acres of filth, and the stench that went with it all, and the thin, now smiling men who have known deprivation, hunger, cold, and in many instances, disease and pain.
In May of 1945, Plambeck sent this dispatch on the victory in Europe.
Speaking from Germany, on the evening of the glad day when the end of the war in Europe was announced to our men here, this is another of those occasions when mere words cannot tell the full story, the story we've waited so long to bring you and the one you've waited so long to hear.
Later in his career, Plambeck covered the Vietnam War and worked for the U.S. Agriculture Secretary before his death in 2001. Veterans can also include beloved war machines that played a crucial role in the Allied struggle, like the B-17 bomber.
We are with the Liberty Foundation, and we have the joy and the honor of bringing this airplane around throughout the country, giving rides to people so they can experience what the B-17 was like. Great living history museum.
John Shuttleworth is a chief pilot for the Liberty Foundation, which owns the bomber, nicknamed the Flying Fortress because of her many 50-caliber machine guns that fought off enemy fighters. The B-17 was the workhorse of World War II. German propaganda films show enemy fighters shooting down the bombers. Boeing built nearly 13,000 of them. More than a third were lost. This American newsreel focused on the terrifying bombing raids over Berlin.
As it bombs away over the German capital.
It was just a heck of a good airplane to fly. We got peppered a lot of times.
Ray Slice from Johnston was one of the Iowans who flew the B-17.
One guy flying a 109, I watched him go over my left wing, and my gunner, top gunner, caught him and he blew up right behind us.
What's it like taking flak?
It's like a popcorn popper. That's all you hear is a lot of rat-a-tat-tat as these pieces of shrapnel came in.
Ray showed me a thumb-sized piece of shrapnel that took out his number 3 engine during a bombing raid over Germany, but he made it back safely on all 35 of his missions.
The American public has always had a love affair going with these kinds of airplanes. You know,
John DuPont is co-pilot of the Liberty Bell.
There's just something about them, the way they sound, what they did for us. The young men that flew them are heroes, every one of them. But the planes are, too.
Get up and walk around.
This is the signature sound of the plane's 4 engines, 1,200 horsepower each. It's like the old movie 12 O'Clock High. We can step over a load of bombs and grab hold of the machine guns.
I am now sitting in a plastic bubble in the nose of the B-17. I have a 360-degree view. I'm a tourist. During World War II, there would have been a gunner sitting here, fully exposed to enemy gunfire.
This is Iowa Public Radio. How was your flight, Captain?
Oh, it's a beautiful flight. Nice, smooth air today. Tailwheel on one, please.
How high were we and how fast were we going?
Well, we got up to about 2,500 feet, and we were flying at 150 miles an hour.
This was one of the last B-17s ever built. She never saw combat. But 2 years after we flew over Iowa, an engine caught fire. The Liberty Bell made an emergency landing near Chicago and burned up. One of the greatest naval vessels ever made had a better ending. The battleship USS Iowa is now a museum in San Pedro, California. The Iowa was one of 4 identical ships with 16-inch guns that could hit targets 24 miles away. This home video, filmed from a nearby vessel, is among many battleship postings on YouTube.
Oh, this is beautiful.
We could see it going through the sky. They always said, well, there goes a Volkswagen through the sky, you know.
Max Fox from Pella was on the Iowa when she pounded targets in North Korea.
All that gunpowder and stuff, it created quite an explosion. Then we'd feel the concussion from that, and it would just about whip her pant legs off, you might say.
So when the battleship fires a full broadside of 9 16-inch guns, the ship actually moves sideways in the water.
The Iowa and her sister ships Wisconsin, Missouri, and New Jersey have a colorful history spanning 4 major wars. This scratchy 1946 recording is titled The Story of the Big Stick and recounts the only time the armor-plated Iowa was hit in the Marshall Islands.
It was there that the Japs reached me for the first and only time of the war with a 6-inch projectile that left an impression like a fingerprint.
Another direct hit.
VIPs on the Iowa include Presidents Roosevelt and Reagan and entertainers Ed Sullivan and Doris Day. But the biggest star of all was the ship itself.
Steam turbines producing 212,000 horsepower.
The Discovery Network's military channel gave these battle wagons its top rating.
But it's the mighty Iowa-class battleship's massive firepower and incredible 35-knot top speed, superior armor protection, and a service length of over 50 years that rightly earns them the title as the greatest fighting ship of all time.
I'm not scared. I'm prepared. We'll be spared. I've got a fallout shelter. It's 9x9.
Hi-fi set and a jug of wine.
Let the missiles fly from nation to nation.
Got the vantage dime in my radiation station.
Coming up, a salute to women in uniform, a family of heroes, and a World War II soldier listens to the Mother's Day greeting he made 63 years earlier. Our tribute to veterans continues after this break. I'm Rick Fredrickson, and this is In Uniform.
Let the press go.
Welcome back to an Iowa Public Radio special that we call In Uniform, a program honoring the men and women who have worn the uniforms of America's armed forces. The crucial role of women in the military has become customary. It hasn't always been that way. In the early days of World War II, Iowa made history.
See that your hair is up off your collar and your blouse buttoned.
Less than 6 months after America entered World War II, Fort Des Moines became the nation's first training center for the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, the WACS. This 1943 film was aimed at getting women to join.
They carry no arms, and their work is far behind the fighting line. But for every WAC volunteer, another soldier is released for combat duty.
It may be propaganda, but the Warner Brothers color film is an important historic relic, showing hundreds of WACs marching past the Iowa Capitol, arriving at Des Moines' old train depot, and in boot camp at buildings now shuttered or gone.
For their first weeks of instruction, the recruits are bunked down in Stable Row. These buildings that were once cavalry stables are the homes of the new WAC.
Some of the women told me they could still smell the horse flesh and horse manure, and, you know, it was an interesting situation, but again, you know, that's a soldier's life, right?
Michael Cates, the former curator of the Fort Des Moines Museum, traveled the country collecting artifacts from the WAC's early days.
I was in California, and this woman showed me, Anita Bean, she showed me this, and I'm like, okay, this is the first time I've ever seen these.
Bloomers? Underwear?
Yes, exactly.
And it's khaki.
Yeah, that's khaki. Yeah, so.
By the right flank! Hutch!
Now in their 80s and up, the first WACs remember marching, the segregated army, and KP, the dreaded kitchen duty. After her training, Marsha Corbett of Waterloo went to Schick Hospital in Clinton, where newly released prisoners of war were nursed back to health.
We were feeding those guys gruel, which is like, oatmeal milk and like that. They had fat tummies and skinny legs, and each time you took care of somebody, you think, do I know him? Is he from my hometown?
Novella Hildreth of Indianola remembers Payday and the commander's pet dog.
You know, you stand there at attention, and she'd have the dog chained to the leg of the desk. The moment you raise your arm, the dog would make a lunge at you and bring the desk with him. It just scared the daylight out of you.
When the first WAC training center opened, men were instructors, including Woodrow Leaf, who was 97 when he was interviewed in Creston.
We had executive women. Women come up there in big cars, and they were secretaries to the president of different companies. And I said, why did you come? Why did you join the WAC? My husband's an Air Force pilot, and he's going to be in there until it's over, and I'm going to go in and be in there as long as he is.
Yeah.
The Corps' first director, Ovetta Kolpavi, had this message for graduating WAC officers at the old fort.
You do not come into a military organization that has an established tradition. you must help make your own.
Women at War. America salutes you.
Today, women are so accepted in uniform that they're found fighting alongside men in trouble spots around the world. Perhaps the woman who gave the most was not in uniform. Alida Sullivan from Waterloo lost all five of her sons in World War II.
You see, sir, we're the Sullivans. We've always been together since we was born, you might say, and that's how we want to go into the Navy.
In the 1944 movie The Fighting Sullivans, we see how George, Francis, Joseph, Madison, and Albert signed up soon after one of their friends died at Pearl Harbor. They were assigned as a group to the USS Juno, a light cruiser. Less than a year after they enlisted, a Japanese submarine sank the ship in the Battle of Guadalcanal. The five Sullivans were among nearly 700 men who died.
The Navy Department deeply regrets to inform you that your sons, Albert, Francis...
It remains the largest single family loss in military history.
Oh, no!
Sometimes I feel like I missed out, because with all five of those boys, all five of the boys dying, there's no children, there's no cousins, it's just us.
Kelly Loughran Sullivan is the face of the family today, the granddaughter of the only brother to marry. She teaches third grade in Cedar Falls. One of her favorite family keepsakes is this scratchy old recording that surfaced long after the boys died.
With a half pint in my pocket and my eyes so black and blue.
The family believes it's the two oldest brothers, George and Frank, who went to a nearby friend's house in Waterloo and sang into an early model disc recorder. It was the home of Bonnie Kolak's grandparents, the Iowa singer-songwriter who still has the historic recording.
My father had a little record playing machine. And so for fun, they had the brothers come over and they had a few beers and they would sit around and sing. And then they recorded this little record.
The brothers sang two songs and clearly were having a good time.
So to actually hear their voices and to hear them singing, you know, one of the songs that we love to sing at St. Patrick's Day especially, one of those goosebump moment experiences, it was just wow.
When Irish hearts are happy.
The Irish-American family is venerated at the Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum in Waterloo. On display, the actual Gold Star flag that hung from their home at 98 Adams Street, the only one in existence with five gold stars. Another of Iowa's war heroes is better known for his more famous career.
Bob Feller winds in the pitch. Vaughn, a ground ball to second. Gordon for one to Crone in the relay. Double play. And the American League is out of the inning, still leading 3-1. With just one pitch, Bob Feller has saved the day.
Baseball legend Bob Feller was gifted with the arm of a Hall of Fame pitcher. He had three no-hitters and struck out more than 2,500 batters for Cleveland. He was also a gun captain on the battleship Alabama. IPR talked to Feller on his 90th birthday.
Well, we were in several different engagements in the Pacific, in the Philippine Sea, and all over the South Pacific, and then above the equator. We crossed the equator 28 times in 1944, engaging the Japanese Navy. And after the Marianas turkey shoot, where we shot down 474 Japanese airplanes one day, that was the end of their naval air force. The heroes don't come home for wars. I am no hero. Survivors return from wars, and I'm a survivor.
Private Gerald Pepper survived World War II, and in 2008, we discovered an old Mother's Day radio show where Pepper and other Iowa soldiers greeted their mothers from Germany. Until we played it 63 years later, he'd never heard it before. The old recording was made by WHO's Herb Plambeck.
Our wire recorder is set up where we can see the majestic snow-capped Alps. With me is a fine group of Iowa men, and on this first weekend after VE Day, they're a happy lot. And
the 30-minute program was found on a 16-inch disc at the Archives of Iowa Broadcasting at Wartburg College. Former museum administrator Jeff Stein joined us at Pepper's home in Ames, where the emotions came flooding back as we all listened together.
There was a little village called Gilgenheim,
that we were bivouacked near. And I recall going up to the little church. It's okay. And the thing that impressed me, strangely, around the entire church, with the exception of the doorway, there was a bin of bones, human bones.
Then we listened to P.F.C. Pepper and the brief recording to his mother, Goldie, who lived in Boone.
This is P.F.C. Girl Pepper in deep in the heart of Germany, hoping his mom has the very happiest of Mother's Days today.
I think I was in pretty good voice. Better than now.
How old would you have been then?
19.
Today, when you go off to war, it's a volunteer army, and you have the ability occasionally to use email and cell phones. And so you're away, but it's not the same as being away for months and years with no contact. What would it have been like to be a mother of a soldier in Iowa? And it's Mother's Day, and you know the war is over, but you still don't have your loved one back.
A happy Mother's Day. We're all glad the crowds are kaput and are looking forward to a speedy reunion with the folks at home.
And to be able to hear the voice for even a few seconds would just be phenomenal.
Their voices came to you by wire recording and on the magic wings of radio.
We lost Private Gerald Pepper in 2011. Before email, Facebook, and Twitter, Vietnam War veterans kept in touch with families the old-fashioned way, with a postage stamp and an occasional long-distance phone call. Some soldiers also had small tape recorders and would send their voice home in audio letters. Robert McKnight was stationed in the Central Highlands 45 years ago and mailed small reel-to-reel recordings to his folks in Burlington. In 1968, Lieutenant McKnight recorded this letter home while sitting in his hooch in Vietnam, complaining about the weather and the war.
It's raining again. The stock on my carbine is mildewed, but it gets cold. This rain feels like it's going to snow. You know, the day before, a real big snowstorm, a wet snow, when there's a strong wind and the rain comes down, it's real fine, and you know it's going to snow. Well, that's how it's like here most of the time. So as I sit here contemplating my room and thinking, boy, I'm never coming back to anything like this once I get away. So you can hang it up as far as me extending for a year, because I don't want to take a chance on ever having to do this again. Once is enough.
High-quality American-made equipment is essential for any military. One of the workhorses going back to World War I was the Liberty Truck. One of the last two still operating can be found at Camp Dodge. This one was built in 1918, and the motor starts with a hand crank. The wheels have wooden spokes and hard rubber tires, and the Liberty's top speed was 14 miles an hour. Old-timers in southern Iowa might remember the sound of a reliable training aircraft that roared in the skies over the Ottumwa Naval Air Station in the 1940s. Nearly 5,000 pilots got their wings here after mastering the Boeing Stearman, a biplane trainer. Many students came here after pre-flight school at the University of Iowa. Elsie May Kofer wrote the history of the air station.
Well, if you've ever heard a Stearman airplane, it's not quiet. I interviewed one fellow who had come into the base and saw 150 planes taking off from one mat and 150 taking off from another mat, just like eight in a row, one right after the other, going to the air. He said it looked like bees coming out of a hive.
Richard Nixon was based in Ottumwa as a young officer. The abandoned administration building is now being restored as the home of a future air and space museum. Iowans have an affinity for their veterans. This procession honored those in uniform at the Iowa State Fair in 2012. 2 years later, the state thanked all service members with a parade through downtown Des Moines. One of the National Guard's most decorated units was among those participating.
All right, ready on the left.
Qualifying with an M16 is something all Iowa soldiers must do.
Are we ready on the right? Firing line is now ready. Commence firing.
Firing at silhouette targets from the prone position, this elite unit is not your typical rifle company. It has won too many marksmanship awards to mention. It is the 34th Army Band.
Everyone came to the band because they like to play music. They may not have ever shot a weapon before, but they take instructions well.
First Sergeant Brent Krumbolz has been playing trombone in the band for 26 years.
There's a great degree of attention to detail that crosses over from one discipline to the next.
Under the baton of Chief Warrant Officer Kent Westlink, who teaches high school band in Clarion, the Army unit is at full strength with 50 members. We dropped in on a rehearsal at Camp Dodge.
The next selection we let's play is Washington Post.
Based in Fairfield, the band's history extends back to 1918. It has performed at the Chicago World's Fair, for General Eisenhower, for dignitaries in Europe, and at President Hoover's funeral. They suffered casualties in World War II.
This tape you are listening to was made on the 25th of October, 1964.
Former Commander Calvin Lowell introduced this recording as music for marching. Over the years, the band's repertoire has expanded. To appeal to different vets from different wars, it breaks down into smaller ensembles to play big band music, jazz, and rock and roll. There's a brass quintet and drum and fife corps. In this old recording, the group performed La Bamba at the Val Air Ballroom. In the 34th's most recent overseas mission, the brass quintet helped Kosovo start up its own military band. We hope you've enjoyed this special program showcasing Iowa's proud tradition of men and women in uniform. Thanks to John Pimble for sound restoration and technical assistance. This has been a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Rick Fredrickson.
Feel the pulse on your long note, too. I'll be conducting it, but listen to each other. Gonna be.
Those that give the last full measure of devotion do so not for the will of governments, not for the promise of glory, but for the hope that in so doing, a fellow soldier will live.